Today's scripture reading comes from the Gospel of John, chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. On the third day there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now standing there were six stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. And Jesus said to them, "Fill them with water." And they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the chief steward." So they took it. When the steward tasted the water that had become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory. And his disciples believed him.
One of my most favorite classes at Phillips Theological Seminary was the late Reverend Dr. Dennis Smith's class on the social world of early Christianity. Some of you may remember a couple Lents ago, we studied the different cultural social system practices and how they influenced life in those early days and how they kind of ran in tandem with Jewish culture and Jewish customs. The main thing out of this was that there were protocols for everything, and weddings were no different. So after the period of the betrothal was finished and all the agreements were last reached and signed, the wedding could take place. And weddings typically extended over a period of 5 to 7 days. And usually the entire village gathered for the wedding. At the beginning of the wedding feast in the evening, the bridegroom, accompanied by his friends, went to get his betrothed from her father's house. A procession was then formed under the direction of one of the bridegroom's friends, who acted as kind of the master of ceremonies and remained by the groom's side throughout the entire time and through the celebration. The bride was carried in a procession. And when the procession reached the bridegroom's house, his parents bestowed a traditional blessing drawn from Scripture and other sources. After the prayers, the evening was passed in games and dancing, and the bridegroom took part in the festivities. But the bride withdrew with her bridesmaids and friends to another room assigned to her. And then the next day was the wedding feast, and once again there was rejoicing, and the village came out in full force to celebrate. There was a meal toward the end of the day where the men and the women were served separately. There was a time for giving of presents. The bride, all dressed in fine garments, surrounded by her bridesmaids, there's usually 10 of them, she sat under a canopy while traditional songs and blessings were sung and recited. Now, during this time in the evening, the groom arrived. Now that the couple was together, everyone came together. Synagogue or other religious leaders imparted blessings to the couple, and they're now together under that beautiful canopy. And after this came the evening feast. And the celebrations went on for many, many, many days. The couple didn't go on a honeymoon, per se, but remained for the rest of the celebration, sharing in the merriment and the songs and the dancing under the star-strewn sky. So, with that context, We find ourselves at a wedding celebration in our text today. And in this moment of joy and beauty and wonder, there is trouble brewing. The celebration is in full swing, and Jesus and the disciples were a last-minute addition to the guest list. Now, wine was a deeply important part of any celebration, especially a wedding. And the family would have planned very, very carefully to have the correct amount of wine. Again, part of the social construct and protocol of the day. And one commentator noted that the piece of this story and puzzle that we're missing is that since they were such a late add to the guest list, Jesus and the disciples may have been told to bring your own bottle. And the same commentator noted that, well, the disciples probably didn't bring any because they didn't have any money. And they were too poor to head to the local alcohol beverage control store to bring their own. And because they didn't bring enough for all the disciples, the wedding ran short. And running out of wine was a breach of protocol. And so the family would have had to deal with that breach. Would the consequence have been shame? Ridicule? Would some have been interpreted as an omen for the newly married couple? Would the family have been looked down upon because of their poverty? And it is in that exact moment that gentle Mary, the mother of Jesus, not wanting this newly married couple and their families to experience shame and ridicule, turns to her son and says, "They have run out of wine." Now, knowing about the Jewish roots of my mother, birth mother and her family, I got a good laugh out of what one commentator said about this statement. Her first words are challenge. And judging by his response, they are an irritating challenge. He is annoyed, to say the least. "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me?" She's, in fact, holding him responsible. Why? Well, the presumption is she wants to show off his special powers. The presumption that she wants to show off his special powers makes her seem like the stereotype in endless Jewish mother jokes. Mother putting her son into his first miracle. Yet, this moment in a place called the middle of this celebration, his words are a form of disengagement. Not rudeness, not rebellion, even though it does come across that way. These words remind us that Jesus has to be called by his inner calling from God, not the world's timetable or any human claim to his authority, not even his mother's. And in this moment, God's extravagant abundance comes through the first public miracle of Jesus, revealing who he was to his disciples while the guests and the bridegroom just think that the good wine was saved till later, which normally would have been served first and the cheap wine later, as protocol dictated. Another example of God's timing breaking human protocol. Based on her need to stand against humiliation, the interchange between Mary and Jesus resembles another historic interchange between Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. on an ordinary day in Montgomery, Alabama. By refusing to give up her seat on the bus or give in to just one more instance of the humiliation of her people, Parks provoked a moment in history, and she provoked King's entry into that moment. In their joint action, his ministry to the nation and the world was opened. She declared the moment was at hand. And he was not at first sure that this was the right moment, but somewhat reluctantly he responded to her situation. And that response became the first of Kings, Dr. King's unforgettable signs, moments of memorable light in a ministry where he lived as John's gospel says Jesus did, offering powerful signs in very ordinary human situations. Dr. King was that moment's vital wine in transforming agent. In his April 1963 letter from Birmingham City Jail, Dr. King responded to eight prominent white liberal Alabama clergymen who had published an open letter in January of that year, calling on King to allow the battle for integration to continue in the local and federal courts and to abandon his methodology of nonviolent resistance. In other words, just wait on the system. Let protocol do its thing. From a testament of hope, the essential writings of Dr. Martin Luther King, here's just a snippet of his response. I am in Birmingham because injustice is here. Just as the 8th century prophets left their little villages and carried their just saith the Lord far beyond the boundaries of their hometowns. And just as the Apostle Paul left his little village of Tarsus and carried the gospel of Jesus Christ to every hamlet and city of the Greco-Roman world, I too am compelled to carry the gospel of freedom beyond my particular hometown. Like Paul, I must constantly respond to the Macedonian call for aid. Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and establish such creative tension that a community that has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue at hand. It seeks to so dramatize the issue that it can no longer be ignored. Jesus' signs, as we continue in the Gospel of John, will grow more stunning. And as we see historically, so do Dr. King's. For both Jesus and Dr. King, the thread connecting all their moments is compassionate justice, which reaches out to raise people from many kinds of death and shame. And in that compassionate justice, the world's protocol is breached again and again and again. And as one author noted, while Dr. King did not change water into wine as Jesus did, he did change words into the new wine of commitment. He did gather thousands to hear him, and they were fed. He did raise those whose lives were decaying in death, the garbage collectors. He did proclaim to the educated Nicodemuses of America that they need to be born again in mind and spirit. He did raise up the dead daughters of Birmingham in an unforgettable letter to the white clergy in the tomb of his jail cell in that city. He did lift up to us a cup of everlasting life. 2018, 50th anniversary of King. And we find ourselves at a crossroads. There is a protocol rising up right now in our nation that is deeply and grossly antithetical to the gospel of Jesus, of Dr. King and his. How powerful and how beautiful in the year of that 50th that our disciple Christ colleague, Dr. William Barber, is leading a new poor people to pick up where Dr. King left. Protocol of systemic racism, poverty, ecological devastation, and a morality in Jesus would not be welcome. We are urgently being called by God to break protocol once again, to demonstrate God's extravagant welcome and abundance. No one is is less than because of their economic or class standing, what country they or their family immigrated from, sexual orientation, gender identity, health status, or class. From the song, "We Are One" by Brian Tate, "And we shall care for one another with all our soul and our might. When we stand, when we fall, when we rise, we are one." These are the gospel values that we stand for, especially today. We have a choice: God's call or the world's protocol. And what will we do?